fascists on the streets in the center of town, fascists violent and violence at the football ground and around the football and so on. And they had the run of the town. And that was what we were specifically going out to do. So a couple of things came out of that. First of all, we were not specifically a political organization. But a couple of people had experiences from past and said, you know, we're not going to discuss what is fascism. It's them, over there, right? We're not going to go into the details of who is and who is not a fascist. We know who exactly the enemy is and what we're going to have to do to deal with it. So I'm going to rewind a little bit in order to explain what militant anti-fascism is about and also what it isn't as well. Britain had a rising fascist movement in the 1930s around mostly, the time of fascism was rising around most of Europe. However, unlike most of Europe, it was not particularly successful. Now, that's not because Mosley didn't have the backing of important figures in the British establishment. Newspaper owners like Lord Rothermere, who, you know, backed Mosley on the front pages of biggest selling daily newspapers of the day, etc. The reason Mosley did not succeed in the end was because of militant anti-fascist opposition to the black shirts, which took part up and down in the consultations with black shirt marchers up and down the country, both in Leeds, in London, back on Cape Street, etc. So, fast forward. Through the post-war period, that tradition of militant anti-fascism was carried on by groups like the 43 groups, some of you may have heard of, maybe not, the 62 group, and then in the 70s, the Anti-Nazi League, the original Anti-Nazi League. And then in the 80s, there was nothing. After the Anti-Nazi League was wound up at the end in 1979, there was nothing. So this is how we found ourselves in the 80s and leagues the fascists had been running the time. The basic principles of the anti-fascist activity we were involved with were, first of all, self-defense. It's the principle of common law that you are allowed to use reasonable force to defend yourself, your family, or any other person from injury or criminal assault. That's the basic principle that we operate under. That was turned into a slogan by the black and Asian people who resisted fascist attacks on them in Southall in the 70s and up in Bradford as well, next door to Leeds. Turned into the self-defense is no offense slogan. And we followed that up by self-defense is common sense slogan. It's also, I want to make a point as well, people, when you start talking about fighting fascism, people raise this question of freedom of speech. We're not talking about speech here. We're talking about behavior. It's not about trying to deal with thought crimes. If people want to stay home and listen to Hitler records and have posters of them on the wall, we don't give a fuck, right? If people want to go out and throw petrol bombs through people's windows, then we care. It's the behavior that we're addressing, not the beliefs. So if I can sum that up in three principles. One of them is self-reliance. From the people of Cable Street through the 43 group right up to anti-fascist action revolving. Self-reliance basically means that we cannot rely on the police to police the fascists. We don't have to have an analysis about why we don't trust the police to police the fascists, because that, you know, that involves your political appreciation of society. But so long as we all agree on that, that is the base of militant anti-fascism. The second thing is that the anti-fascist struggle is not the exclusive property of any one group. That is to say, we always try to hold in Leeds a group that could include people from the left, people from liberal sides, Muslims, Jews, Christians, whoever. All people have very, very different reasons, possibly, for fighting fascists. And possibly as many reasons to have disagreements internally, but we said we're not going to talk about this. All we're going to do is get it together for the sole purpose of dealing with the Nazis. And we can have our other arguments outside of this, but together on this, this is how we operate. But in order for that to work, you cannot allow any one group to say that we control the anti-fascist struggle, join our struggle. As a friend of mine said, this is a black guy who's involved in anti-racist anti-fascist struggles for many decades in England. He always questioned when he was confronted by certain social, mainly white socialist left groups of saying, black and white unite. said, well, unite with whom and on whose terms? So for us, it was always very important that we came together without any preconditions of someone signing up to join somebody else's struggle under somebody else's leadership. The third thing, and the most important thing probably, is that it is a concrete struggle, not an abstract struggle. That is to say, we are not fighting fascism in the abstract. We are fighting living, breathing fascists. And by that means that in order to be effective, we need to know who these fascists are. We need their photographs. We need their names. We need to know where they live, where they work. We need to know where they drink and what they think. Only by knowing these things, so it's an intelligence-led operation, only by knowing these things can we then predict what it is they are going to do and how they are likely to react when we make interventions into their plans. And also, how we can manipulate them as well, so that they either give up, fight amongst themselves, etc. But it is a concrete struggle. We're talking about fascists here, we're not talking about fascism in the abstract. You must know your enemy. So there is an intelligence necessity. And those are the three main principles. The underlying idea is as well that just because militant anti-fascism requires being having common sense about the practicalities of confronting people who are prepared to use violence in their political ends. And that's how we define fascism, basically. It's not politicians on TV making racist comments. It's thugs on the streets putting bricks through windows. It's the practice that we are attacking. The danger that you fall into with that is some people get sucked into the idea that militant anti-fascism therefore means that you have to be someone who is personally up for physical combat. That's not at all the case. Everyone has a role to play in the struggle, as somebody once said. And that applies to militant anti-fascism as well, because most of the intelligence stuff that we get, for example, comes from people doing research, from infiltrating groups, from sitting in posts while they're having meetings, being inconspicuous and so on. None of those things involve any physical confrontation. So it's about the approach, not the actual activity. That's the important thing. There is a need to have stewards groups who will deal with the necessity of confronting fascists hand-to-hand if necessary, be that simply whether sitting at the door, defending meetings. My first activity in these anti-fascist sessions was actually defending them. Doing security for an Anne Frank photograph exhibition the council was doing to stop being attacked by that. So a lot of that kind of activity, but that's a specific role within a militant anti-fascist group. It is not the totality of what a group does. The second thing is, with all this scarily military-sounding thing, this is not a war. There's a great line from the American TV series, The Wire, where one of the cops says to the other cops, you know, this war on drugs thing is a load of nonsense. This is not a war. He says, how do you figure that? He says, wars end. And that's the thing. Anti-fascist struggle does not have any victory conditions. There is nowhere that we can storm and plant a flag on it and say, fascism is over. It is more of a, in a UN speak, it's more of a sort of peacekeeping operation. Or to be very controversial in an anarchist context, it's more of a policing operation, if you like. However, it's not, which brings us back to the liberal challenge. It's like, well, why don't you let the police deal with it? It's their job, we pay them for it. Why don't we just lobby our politicians to let the police deal with it? And that, I guess, is where I'm going to come back to our specifically anarchist approach to this, about why the principle we started with of self-reliance, not trusting the police, is fascist, from our point of view, doesn't work. And why we reject the label of being anti-fascist cops. That is, the police has not been an internal feature of our society for all time. The police is a relatively new invention. It came about by Mr. Peel in London. It's an invention of capitalism, and it's specifically an invention of class society. That is to say, police is not a neutral force in our society. It is here to prevent working class strength. whether it's by relying on culture dependence so that we don't sort out our own social problems, we don't police ourselves, and all that sort of thing, with direct confrontation and things like strikes and so on. But above all, it is a force that is hostile to the development of working class power. Now, fascism and racism is obviously a factor that breaks up work class unity by dividing themselves against themselves and so on. So it's not surprising that police are not automatically hostile to fascism. And it is the fact that when we are fighting against racism and fascism, we're trying to build solidarity amongst different communities of which we're made up. And in doing so, we're doing actually the opposite of what the police's job there to do, which is to weaken class unity. We're trying to promote it and to strengthen it. So from that point of view, it was more of an anti-police role than a police role. Okay. I'll give you a couple more examples of activities we carry out. When we started, there was a big march. Was John Tyndall with BNP was sort of building an alternative Remember Sunday march up in York. Mainly because he fallen out with the NF guys who were doing the Remember Sunday march down in London. But they decided to go to York instead because there's a place there called Clifford's Tower, which is the site of the biggest anti-Jewish pogrom in English history. So they like to go there. They like to say it was because of the Viking Castle in the north, but they went to Clifford's Tower and had their rally there for that reason. So the way we went about organizing this is we helped form a group with York University, and we mobilized students from York University and took about 600 people down and occupied the space outside of Clifford's Tower. Having occupied the space, the police obviously had demanded a ban on all marching activities once they were aware that it was going to be a counter demonstration to the fascist demonstration on Remembrance Sunday. Once we were there in time, in place, with our perimeters sort of secured, they had no alternative but to turn fascists away. So that's an example of militant anti-fascism that does require a certain amount of organization and being serious about having the stewards to protect 600 students. You know, if there were not the stewards there, a group of 100 fascists could come up and actually attack a group of 600 students and probably hurt them and run them away, right? So you do need to be serious about having a certain number of people who know what they're doing to secure that group. But then through force of numbers, you can win the day without a punch being thrown. So that's what I mean about militant anti-fascism is not simply squadism as such, right? Gangs of balding, beer-bellied men fighting it out in pub car parks about whose ground it is. Another activity we took part in, which was the problem that we had at the football ground, Leeds United, was notorious in the late 70s and early 80s. As a club where the fascists have very strong presence and a big influence on football hooligans and on the whole home fan thing. We knew that if we went down there, we'd already got rid of the paper sale in town, basically through direct confrontation methods. But we knew if we went down and tried that at the football ground, we'd just all get nicked. So we had to play quite a wide game. We had to go and talk, we had to bring the trade unions on board. We got the backing of the TUC. We then used them to get the council on board, or not on board, but at least leverage them into allowing us to go down to hand out leaflets against racism and fascism at Elm Road. So it took a long time of political campaigning. And again, you know, this is not just simply cracking heads. This is using your political nous about, okay, who can we talk to? To get to talk to them so that we can take 100 people down to Elm Road with anti-racist leaflets and not get arrested and leaflet the fans and put pressure on the football club itself to sort things out. Anyway, as a result of those activities, the football club did finally hire Wilkinson as a new manager, and his precondition for coming to Leeds said, I will not come to Leeds unless you allow me to sign black players, which it said they hadn't done for 12 years because they were too afraid of front of the fans. Once we created the conditions down at the ground, saying, no, there is opposition to racism at the ground. And we got support from the fans for doing that, because, of course, once we're there handing leaflets out, people are going like, where the fuck last 12 years. I thought I was the only one here on the ground thinking, God, this is awful. You know, so we were able to mobilize support from ordinary Leeds fans who'd been intimidated by what was going on, but thought they were the only ones. And gradually, we turned the culture around at Elland Road. So that was for which we got the proposal from the board in 86, 88, something like that. Sorry, getting old memory, you know. So those are just examples, again, of campaigns that we led which required being very serious about our security, required sorting out our intelligence, but weren't just about throwing balls at people. So hopefully we'll be able to approach whatever fashion problem you have in Belfast and along similar lines.
Does anyone have any comments or questions? Keep it short and brief. Maybe if people say a few things and then we'll get the people here and come back.
Well, I'm happy to say that the nationalists and the Roman Catholic tradition hasn't had the same bad PR as the Protestant community has. But that's largely by good fortune, because there are plenty of sort of small-minded people in nationalist areas too. I know one or two of them. But SCA Limited, used to be called Springfield Charitable Association, ran a whole sequence of annual races against racism, and that sort of stemmed any overt racism that was in our West Belfast community. And now we're going to move it on a wee bit. We're now calling it the Race to Embrace, and it is now going to be Falls and Shankill. That'll be later this year, so flag it up for everybody to get a wee bit of exercise done and join in. I would like to say that the real reason that the Protestant community, I think, has been vilified, actually, in practice, so, is there's been an influx in the cheapest housing, and that's a sort of sink deprivation states, little ghettos, to use a thoughtful word, of Protestantism, and that's why the low rent sector became where the immigrants went. I don't think the Protestants are genetically racist.
Does anyone have any argument we have before we come back? And then talk.
Just on your point there, as you were saying about the race against racism, you know, first back the tide of racism. When I remember back, the majority of the recent attacks did stem from a lot of loyalists, I want to call that working class areas, but there was attacks on the minority ethnic community in nationalist Republican working class areas, and it was pushed back the same way it was pushed back, and the same tactic was pushed back in all working class areas. It was the mobilisation of the people within the community. I remember going to rallies in the Lower Falls with hundreds and hundreds of people to come out. They were the people who leave the doors of their neighbours. So, and the same thing happened in our areas as well. So it's the same type of tactics in different areas. And I'm very interested in what Paul was saying there, because my whole life experience is learning things from practical experience. I read things from books, but the way, speaking personally, I learn things is through the course of struggle and utilise the tactics and lessons learned through that. Now, it's very interesting to listen to Paul's experience, because a lot of the stuff that they used in anti-fascism, a lot was actually used in combating racism during the height of the recent attacks, leading mobilisations, you know, rallies and stuff like that at the same time as well, because a lot of people have perceptions that anti-fascism is, a Milton anti-fascism is all about squadism and taking people on. And so it was interesting to hear that it involves a broader range of things there. It does involve mobilising people, it does involve stewardism, it does involve writing leaflets and stuff, and utilising different facilities and engaging with different people, but albeit with the understanding that you're not taking on racism, you're taking on fascism. So I've learned a lesson here today, because for me, you know, I do read a lot about Milton anti-fascism.